Welcome to the Oldie Writing Course with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. We've got terrific speakers, Mary Kenny on how to write a column, Sam Leith, the Spectator's literary editor, on how to write a review, William Cook, the Oldie's theatre critic, on how to write a travel feature, and Elizabeth Luard, our cookery correspondent, on how to write the Substack. I've been billed to write about the do's and don'ts of journalism, as well as being the editor of the Oldie for 8 years. I spent a desperate 9 years as a freelance journalist, so I spent an awful lot of time pitching to newspapers and magazines and learning to mask my disappointment when I got rejected, or even worse, not getting an answer at all, which happens a lot. And these are obviously no hard and fast rules. You know, journalism, although it's a lowly trade, is also a sort of art, so there are no hard and fast rules. You all have your own ways of doing these things. But I do think there are very, very strong guidelines, which I've learned from people over the years, which are really useful, and also a lot of papers and magazines, although they never give you these guidelines because they seem so obvious once you start employing them, they almost certainly won't commission you unless you follow at least the most basic of them. I remember when I was doing a feature for the Daily Mail, which I'd done for a few years freelance, and I asked the editor on one column, which was a bit tricky to do, how should I go about doing this? And he said, in a very dismissive, world-weary way, says, start off with a personal story, drop in the peg, which I will explain as the relationship to the actual news story, and then fill in the rest of the column. And he was quite right, that's an extremely good, straightforward way of doing a column. And he was a bit amazed that I didn't know how to do that after a couple of years. A lot of the things I'll be saying might be familiar to you, forgive me if you know them before, but the crucial thing to go away as you go home this evening is with the image of a pyramid or a triangle, which works both when you're pitching for an article and in the article itself. And the idea of the triangle is you have the most important thing at the top of a story, at the intro and at the beginning of the pitch. If it's a winner of a running race or Trump news, you say in the first sentence the most important things, what happened, and then you can start saying more and more general things. That will vary in much longer pieces. So there's a extremely good memoir coming out next week by Graydon Carter, the great former editor of Vanity Fair, which is a lot of it is tips about journalism. I really recommend it, coming out over here next week, called The Golden Age of Magazine Journalism. And he says that in really long pieces, like Vanity Fair would sometimes have a 20,000-word piece about the famous time Deep Throat from Watergate was revealed in 2005. They gave up practically the whole of the magazine to that fantastic scoop. And with a longer story like that, he said sometimes he would let the actual news story, the actual fact about this was all about, be as late as the 17th paragraph. You almost had a formula. But you don't want that in, say, a sports story, although sometimes, no disrespect, Meredith, to our American friends, but before I went to America to be the New York correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, I was told by my predecessor at the Oldie, the great Alexander Chancellor, he said, be aware about how late in the story they will introduce the news story. And he told me an apocryphal story about a front page American football game, huge Super Bowl result, and you didn't see who won until you got to the turn, until you turned the page. I thought, this couldn't be true. And then when I was there in New York about 20 years ago, there was a story about Lindsey Vonn, the great American skier, and it started off with an incredibly long intro saying, so there was Lindsey at the start. Would she make it to the end? Wasn't until you turned to page 7 that you learned that she'd actually won the race. Well, I would say, no disrespect, Meredith, but in a news story, get the story in early. There are essentially, broadly speaking, I'd say two types of journalism. One is the me journalism, which is basically stories about yourself, which has boomed over the last 20 years. One of the great exponents of it, and does it brilliantly, is Giles Corran of the Times. A friend of mine refers to it as Eskimo German journalism, because of the apocryphal story that when an Eskimo captures a whale, It uses every part of the body, so it takes the blubber to make ice cream, the eyebrows to make toothbrushes, and the Eskimo journalists, anything that happens to them could become story. You'll always see people who do this brilliantly or not so well. So they trip up on the street on the way into the oldie journalism course, break an ankle. Ooh, that's a thousand words in the Daily Mail. The great Hunter Davis, a friend of mine in his late 80s, who had a very severe heart operation. I saw him shortly afterwards, looking quite frail. I said, "How are you, Hunter?" He said, "Oh, fantastic. I've got two pieces in the mail, one at a time." So that's the way to approach journalism. And then, obviously, the other side, so there's Eskimo or me journalism, and then there's journalism about the outside world. Now, the good thing about Eskimo me journalism is that you are the only one who can write it. So you've already got your USP, your unique selling point. We have an example here. We have the great Bond girl, Madeleine Smith. Second row, you'll recognise her from Live and Let Die, when Roger Moore tried to remove her dress with a magnetic digital watch. But Madeleine wrote a terrific piece about being a Bond girl. Now, no disrespect on the audience, perhaps there are other Bond girls here, but that's a complete USP, and you can write that. I can't remember, Madeleine, if there was a particular anniversary then. I don't think there was, but that's such an interesting, unique story that can go at any time. If you're not in a unique position like that, you've got to convince somebody, if you're doing me story, that your story is interesting enough. We have a terrific columnist. I'm not sure all of you read The Oldie, but there are extremely good deals going at the moment. But we have a brilliant columnist called Jem Clark, who lives with his parents in Cleethorpes in his 50s. And he just sent in on spec a very, very funny piece. And he's now been doing a column for 4 years, and that is me about his tragicomic life. I mean, a lot of these columnists, almost like tragedies come swarming towards them, or perhaps sometimes, I'm not saying Jim does it, they turn up the dial, but a tiny little hangnail is in fact a catastrophic visit to casualty. But so you can, if you're a brilliant writer, which I'm sure you all are, take the everyday and write about it very amusingly. And then that second category, talking about the outside world, well, there are a million and one people who want to be journalists, who are journalists, and with the advent of the internet, are basically citizen journalists. So you've got to convince people why it should be you writing about, say, the journalist telling for Mr. Zelensky to wear a suit last week. That was a perfect example of it. A huge news story, the actual thing of Trump telling off Zelensky. But then there were lots of secondary stories about, you know, when should you wear a suit to the office, that sort of thing. So if you've got lots of people vying to write about the same thing because of a huge news event, well, you've got to make clear in your pitch why you should be the one who's writing about it as to a million other people. And you can. There are a thousand ways to skin a dead cat that actually, with a big news story, or even a small but interesting one, they can go on having so-called pegs, and I must explain the idea of a peg for those who don't know it. A peg is like a peg you hang your coat on. A peg is something to hang your story on. So it could be something huge, international news, like Trump and Zelensky, or it could be something quite small. I noticed today, in fact, Giles Corrigan, in his restaurant column, he's always trying to find an interesting way to review a restaurant. And he goes to the Lamb and Flag, one of the pubs in Oxford, where the Inklings, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien used to gather to drink and discuss their characters. And it closed a few years ago during COVID, reopened again in 2022. So that's a long way ago, long time ago, in order to write a news story about reopening. But his news story, which I hadn't read about, was that they had a gathering in this pub just this week where AI was charged with coming up with to write poems, and then half a dozen of the best undergraduate poets were asked to write poems, and then Giles, as one of the judges, tried to work out who was the real person, whether it was AI or not. And thank God the real person won. They recognised the real person was marginally better than AI, but that was a way of using it. Coming up with a new peg about what was actually rather an old story. But that pub itself, I've noticed over the year, because I'm one of the when it closed, they went to people who used to go there to try and raise money, and I'm one of the people who when I say to my sister I own a pub, she said, well, actually you own the chair leg in one pub. So 300 people put in anything from £1,000 to much more. But I wrote an article when it opened. I noticed someone else wrote an article when it closed, and here's Giles again doing it now. So, but he's the first I've seen to write about this debate. So if it's not going to be me journalism, if it's about an outside thing, you've got to have your own original take on writing a piece. And also the crucial thing, very obvious, but again, not necessarily obvious if you haven't done it before, is timing. When do you actually pitch an article? So I quite often at the Aldi get emails, polite emails from authors saying, can you possibly review my book? And I think, yeah, sounds interesting. And then they say, it's out today. And you want to say to them, I completely understand, but, you know, actually, the Aldi at the moment, for example, we're now working on June's books, so we're working 3 months ahead. So if you, perhaps some of you in the audience have just written a book or want to, planning ahead is crucial. So if you were to say, now I've got a book coming out in July, that would be great. And I haven't got many books in the office at the moment. They are coming out in July, so almost certainly you would go, oh right, you give it proper examination. Those lead times, which is essentially the time between you go to press and the time you come out, vary massively in magazines. So we come out once every 4 weeks. We go to press on a Friday. The actual magazine doesn't come out for 12 days after that. So we couldn't, if something, if there was, God forbid, a terrible bomb out there, actually the Aldi couldn't, and you were here to cover it, the Aldi wouldn't be the place to go to, because our next issue isn't coming out for 3 weeks. But all you would immediately get onto the news desk of the Times or the Guardian or whatever it might be, and say, I could do it today for tomorrow's paper. Even newspapers, which are obviously come out every day, but actually some of their pieces, like our pieces, will be planned months ahead. So those are things like, you know, the whole publishing industry, film industry, music industry, theatre industry have laid things out so that there are chances to go to previews several months ahead. And so for exactly the same reason, one wouldn't go to the Times saying, can I review the new book or the new Bridget Jones film, unless you're doing it a couple of months ahead. The flip side of that is, not for the Aldi, but for newspapers, they do, I'd say, about half of anything you see in a paper was written the day before, which is pretty extraordinary. So there is huge capacity for doing things on the day. In that scenario, it's always good to think about the poor hungover journalists at their news desk or at the arts desk. They normally, always good about thinking of their own day, they tend to, when I was at various papers, your first meeting tend to be 9:30 or 10 in the morning, and quite often, including myself, you'd go into the, you'd get there at 9 in the morning, whatever, and wouldn't have a good idea. I was on the comment page of the Telegraph trying to come up with an idea. If someone sent you an idea at that peak time of about 8:30 or 9 in the morning, you could rush into the editor's office saying, oh, I've got a brilliant idea. We've got Susan Richards on the history of cement, or whatever it might be. But so it's the point is to get it to them at the right time. So if you're interested in doing news articles or news features, ideally have read all the papers first in the morning, so you make sure that article hasn't been written that day, and come up with your own angle on it, and get that pitched to them by about 9:30 a.m. It's the same. I know we've got some authors in the audience here. If you've written a book, you'll have a bit more wriggle room because you've written your book. If say your book's coming out in June, you can get in touch with a news desk or a feature desk or an arts desk. I'd say anything up to a week before your book comes out. And you can, if you're doing a, particularly if you've written a non-fiction book, you can slice that up into, we've got William Cook, will talk to you here later today at the back. I'm sure you've done it with your non-fiction books, trying to pitch to as many different papers and magazines with as many different ideas by salami slicing your book into different aspects. And it's the same with doing a pitch if you read The Guardian one morning about some of your specialist subject and the book is coming out and you go, oh my god, Marina Hyde's got there first. Well, you can always try and come up with a different angle on the same thing. Now, from the point of view of the actual how you do a pitch as opposed to writing an article, bear in mind that editors, I probably get about 200 pitches a week, and so it's got to be short and pithy, and that same pyramid idea that, let's say here we are in the Marx Memorial Library, let's say you knew your mother was a friend of Lenin's or whatever, and that day there'd been a new statue put up to Lenin in Moscow. Just think off the top of my head, the first thing you say is hello, and then you go, my mother was a tremendous friend of Lenin, I thought it'd be interesting on the day the statue goes up to write about it. And that's, and basically you can tell within that first sentence, don't do the Graydon Carter thing of dropping in 17 paragraphs in the reason why you're going to write this article. That's the first thing you say is, bang, that's the story. And then you can say, I can talk to Lenin's great nephew, and I've been there myself and I've got some photos. But really, given that most editors will have hundreds of pictures to look at in a week, the thing is to make it as short as possible. I would say maximum 2 paragraphs, or ideally 1 paragraph. If you can, in some very subtle way, demonstrate you have a sense of style, not least the ability to be able to spell the word Lenin correctly, for example, but also if you can very, very subtly, not by overdoing your Baroque prose, but show that you're a subtly witty or original writer, that'd be good. But that needn't matter too much, because people are constantly thinking, whether it's a magazine like The Oldie or newspapers across the world, it's a story, story, story. If it's a good original story, then you're going to grip them. Crucial tip is keep to word length. Quite a lot of writers who shall go unmentioned who are brilliant writers for The Oldie, but you say, can I have 850 words on Norwegian fish, and they'll send you 3,000 words and they think they're doing you a favour. Actually, they're not. But meaning, you know, all our lives are so full of constant emails. It means yet another email saying, I'm sorry, Eric, or whoever, can you cut it down to 3,000 words, or shall I? Either way, you then got to wait while Eric does it, or do it yourself, and you may not have the time that day, particularly if it's something that's got a very topical side to it. So it's completely crucial to do it to length. I work with the late, great Bill Deeds at the Telegraph, who was in his 90s when I worked with him. He was astonishing. He'd been won the MC in the Second World War. He'd been a cabinet minister. He had been the editor of the Telegraph from 1974 to 1986, and he was still coming in to do the kind of Sunday shift with me, or whoever the most junior person was, in his 90s. And he, every time, in the old ATEX computer system we had, it would come with what the word length was of the piece you'd written at the bottom. Every time, if it was a 300-word leader, it wouldn't be 299, it'd be 301. And I think for all this confidence for this extraordinary career, he always thought he's about to get the chop, and so he was just completely to length every time, and never, ever a grand, which he could have been as a former editor, but that's why so many successive editors loved him, because he wasn't aggressive or grand. Those word lengths will vary enormously, and you've got an idea. Again, remember, there are a million ways to skin a cat. Sometimes you may have a fantastic idea. Somebody sent one the other day about the incredibly annoying thing of making a complaint. In his case, it was about a suitcase not turning up at Madrid Airport on the conveyor belt. And I said, oh, that's perfect for our... We have a tiny little section called a rant column, which is something you're really angry about. As for our rant column at 330 words, And he said, in a very polite, nice way, but he said, I was thinking more about 2,000 words. And I said, well, you can do that somewhere else, but I'm afraid that that is the length. And to be fair, he did it, and it's absolutely brilliant. But so bear in mind that there, you can box and cox to fit your ideas into different spaces, and it's very much worth looking at something like a copy of the Oldie or whatever magazine or paper you read, or what the pitch to get an idea of length. So just for the Oldie, this is about standard. A page is around about 850 words. Two pages, 1,200 words. Very occasionally we do three pages, which can go up to 2,000 words. But so if you have some magnum opus on suitcases which you want to insist on writing about 10,000 words, well, the Oldie isn't the place to do it, but you might find Suitcase Weekly will wrap it up. But the thing is to cut your cloth. It is difficult game, journalism, the payment has gone down over the years, and the circulation of the recognised papers and magazines has gone down over the years. But at the same time, whenever we complain about people being on their phones the whole time, people are reading more than ever, and the outlets, not always well paid, but sometimes, have expanded massively. So it's trying to work out what your where your idea will best be suited. And again, there might be articles. Suitcases is a good idea, a good example actually, which they may be well suited to a magazine you haven't even read yourself. But it's worth going to one of those few remaining newsagents with all the magazines on the wall and saying, "I've got this article about suitcases. Ah, Condé Nast Traveller," and then buy a copy and read it. Again, this seems so statement of the bleeding obvious, but read the magazine you're going to pitch to, if only one issue, and then you might find it's the perfect fit. One of my own Eskimo journalism things, I went in the footsteps of Odysseus about 10 years ago, reconstructing the Odyssey around the Mediterranean, and I went into a newsagent thinking, well, I could try and pitch half a dozen articles to the papers and the magazines, and then I saw Boat International magazine, and there's a good example of I pictured them then when the book came out, and they weren't interested, and then just now, literally 10 years after the book came out, because of the tragic death of poor Mike Lynch, you know, the billionaire tech man who was tragically killed off Sicily in exactly the same spot where Odysseus avoided Charybdis, the whirlpool extraordinary. Then, finally, Boat International kindly agreed to run a piece. So, bear in mind, there can be a long, 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 long life in this piece. If you are pitching, as I said earlier on, it's quite a tough game because you'll get rejected a lot. Actually, even worse than being rejected is silence. These people are very busy and they get hundreds. I try to respond to every pitch, but I don't always manage to. And that is really annoying if you're a journalist. But take rejection on the chin and keep on trying. It's good to build up as many different contacts as possible. It's not hard to find the names of various people on or different desks. Quite often they'll say at the bottom of a paper or a magazine the email address of people to write to. It might be a generic one, like editorial at theoldie.co.uk. You're welcome to send ideas to me there, and I see all of them. Even better if you can find the name of the woman on the comment desk at The Guardian or the features desk on the Telegraph. And it really is quite easy to do. You just put up features desk editor The Guardian in Google and very often it'll come up and then you know it's got to them. I would say never duplicate a pitch, so never send exactly the same pitch to the lady in The Guardian, the lady at the Times at the same time, because it'd be great if it happened. They might both say yes, and then you're in the awkward position. You certainly couldn't have the piece in two different papers on the same day. You're in the awkward position of saying, I'm so sorry, time's already taken it, and all these hard-working, hungover editors will think, oh, bloody hell, I'm not going to use Susan Richards again. She's been pitching to everybody. So, again, it's sort of like a pyramid. You start, in terms of pitching, pitch with the person you'd most like your piece to appear in. If they say no, or I give them, if you've got a bit of time, I give them a day to respond. If they don't get back after a day, then go to your second favourite, and so on and so on. There's nothing wrong, though, with if you're going to be doing two pitches about very, very different things, obviously, on the same day. Sometimes you'll get, very rarely, but you see somebody, it's called a right and a left, like in shooting. People say, oh, God, I see you've got a right and a left in The Times and The Guardian. And they very slightly mind that, but that's don't mind it enough to take the edge off the pleasure of getting two pieces in one day. But as long as they're two very different pieces, if you're writing, say, about suitcases and the Odyssey, two separate pieces, that's fine. But to pitch the same thing in a boilerplate way to different people is not a good thing. It sounds so obvious, and I don't dare say it to people as distinguished as you, but spelling and grammar is absolutely crucial. I know that should go without saying, but quite often people do get things wrong in the pitch, and you just go, there is no point in using this person. The great A.N. Wilson, our oldie man of letters columnist, was for many years, and a prolific writer of over 60 books, he was for many years the literary editor of the Evening Standard. He was there for about a decade, and when he started the job, he thought, I'm going to get the world's greatest reviews. I'm going to get Shakespeare reviewing, Proust, Chaucer reviewing even more, etc. He said by the end of the 10 years, he was really happy if somebody delivered a piece on time, to length, and they were capable of spelling the word cat correctly. So that seems like a low bar, but by doing that, you're already knocking out, I'd say, 40% of the opposition. As I said, if you're going to risk writing in areas you're not a world expert on, that's fine if you can convince people that you're really good on that tiny area, say, of economics that you're interested in writing about. Don't overpromise your knowledge. Many of you might know the famous story of Tom Stoppard before he became an eminent playwright. Was a journalist on a Bristol local paper. And he went for his interviews. He was writing about local politics. And the editor said, oh, Mr. Stoppard, I see your interest in politics. That's useful for this job. He said, Mr. Stoppard, can you tell me the name of the current Chancellor of the Exchequer? And Tom Stoppard said, I told you I was interested. I'm not obsessed. So be careful of opining on something you're not an expert unless you can keep it to the tiny parameters. Be prepared also to write that day, particularly for newspapers. It's not the same for the oldie, except on very rare occasions because we have longer lead times. If you're pitching to a newspaper, it sounds obvious, but particularly about a news event that day, you very often, if you succeed, will be asked to write a piece that day. And sometimes people are horrified about that, I once rang up a former master of Balliol College, Oxford, when there was a row about Oxford. He's a very nice old boy. I said, would you write 800 words on this? And he said, oh, yes, I'd absolutely love to. And I said, can we get it by 5 o'clock today? This is about 10 in the morning. He said, well, it's a bit tricky. I said, well, we could, at a squeeze, do it tomorrow lunchtime. He said, could get it to you in 2 months. And to be fair, I'd rang him up, but if you're going to write for a newspaper, be clear that you've got time that day to do it. Payment, important, crucial issue. Many journalists quite rightly don't do anything for nothing. I'd say on the whole that's helpful and a good idea, unless if you're, say, promoting a book. There might be some knock-on effect for writing for free somewhere. Rates have gone down over the years. They haven't, I'm afraid, at the oldie gone up that much, but they haven't ever gone down. They are, just so you know, to give you an idea, they're £250 for a page, £350 for a spread, which is a word for two pages. That will vary massively across the papers, although a lot of them have cut their fees. The Daily Mail used to work on a classic rate of 50p a word. They've now dropped that to, I'm not quite sure what it is, but a little bit less than that. But it's always worth asking in a polite way, A, if they're going to pay, completely reasonable for us, and B, how much. But only best to ask that once they've commissioned it, because if you say, I've got my piece on suitcases, how much you're going to pay me, that doesn't sound so good. But if you say, I've got my piece on suitcases, the editor goes, yes, and it's completely reasonable to say, are you going to, how much might you pay? If they then say nothing, well, then you're completely free to remove your business, but it's completely reasonable. And also, if you think it's derisory and from a paper that's doing very well, again, in a polite way, it's perfectly fine to say, if they say we'll pay you 20p a word, again, it's completely okay to say, is there any chance of any more than that? Put it politely. And then if they say no, it's up to you whether you accept the work or not. And as I say, even when magazines pay, or papers pay very little, it can be quite useful in the long run. There's a story at Literary Review, the brilliant literary magazine, which terrific place. I occasionally do reviews for them, and they pay the grand sum of £25 for a review, which they have been doing for about 30 years. But the editor is extremely nice, Nancy Sladek, and you never know, someone unusual might read that review. And in fact, there's a story about the late Pat Kavanagh, who was a super literary agent. She was, in fact, Martin Amis's agent. She was married to Julian Barnes. And Martin Amis began as a literary journalist on The New Statesman, and then he became, obviously, very famous with his novels. And he said, said to his agent, Pat Kavanagh at the time, said, let's say early 80s, I'm not going to go on writing for the Literary Review. I'm paid 25 quid a time. I think it was the same in 1983 as it is now. And she said, no, Martin, you should go on doing that because, okay, you're paid peanuts, but it's got a decent circulation of, I don't know, about 15,000, and it's read by, often read by extremely interesting, possibly crucial people. So he did go on writing for them. And there was a letter the other day in the TLS which proves the point. There was a letter from an elderly intellectual man living in New York City about some aspect of film, signed by a regular subscriber, Martin Scorsese. And so you never know. There's no actual story of him saying, I love that review, can I make a film out of the book? But it's not inconceivable. So I would say, if you've got the enough time, it can be very useful, even in a magazine or newspaper not of a huge circulation. We're not really here talking about writing about writing books, but I'm sure many of you have written books. I know some of you have written books, and perhaps some of you do want to write books. Very much for the same reason. Books don't necessarily sell in the millions, but the really good thing about writing a book about anything from suitcases to the Odyssey is that you are then recognised, because editors and journalists tend to read more books or read about books more than other people. You then become known as the suitcase expert or the Odyssey expert. So next time there's a suitcase scandal or a terrible story like the poor Mike Lynch dying in Sicily, they then come to you. As I said, when you do write a book, you can then slice it up into different chunks for newspaper articles, but also that can have extraordinary knock-on effects. I've got a friend called Joshua Levine, who's been writing books about the Second World War for 15 years, and he suddenly had a huge break when somebody went to the RAF museum in Hendon and bought a copy of his book about Dunkirk, gave it to her husband for Christmas, and her husband was Christopher Nolan, and they then made a film using his book as the main inspiration. And then Christopher Nolan happened to be a friend of Steve McQueen, the artist, not the film star, who said when Steve McQueen was thinking of doing a book about the Blitz, he gave Steve McQueen a copy of Josh's book on the Blitz. And so those things have done very well for him when the books themselves did fine, but not as well as once they've got that boost. So all of these things have unusual afterlives. So we've got a bit of time. So what I'm going to ask you to do, two separate things, write a pitch for your dream article. It might actually be an article you want to write for The Oldie. And then separately write your first paragraph of the prospective article. Imagine I said yes to it, what your first paragraph would be. So your pitch about your dream commission, it might be something that you genuinely want to have commissioned for The Oldie, and then how you'd write your first paragraph of that article. So I'll give you about 5 minutes to do that, and then Amelia, has anyone got a pen and paper in there? Yeah, and then I'll come and collect your pieces, and I'll read them during the day, and I'm sure they'll all be brilliant, but some of them may make it into the magazine. So I'll come and collect them in 5 minutes.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.